The author of Hebrews likes to use athletic illustrations, and as I was preparing this message, there was one that came to mind. I think at least a few of you will remember when this took place and can relate to it. From 2000 to 2003, Bill Self coached the University of Illinois men's basketball team. And his record was 78-24 in that span, which at that point was the best three-year run the Illinois basketball team had ever had. Each year he led his team into the NCAA tournament, and Bill Self's strength was recruiting, and he was bringing in some of the top athletes to the University of Illinois. And the expectations grew every year. But in 2003, he had the opportunity to coach at the University of Kansas, and he took that job. So Illinois then hired Bruce Weber from Southern Illinois University to replace him. And right from the get-go, Weber was constantly compared to his predecessor. Everything that happened, the press was very quick to second-guess and compare and judge, especially if the team came out with less than a stellar effort. And so in December of 2003, that first year he was coach, right before a game, he appeared in a black suit and tie. And he announced that this was a funeral. It was a funeral of Bill Self as the coach of the University of Illinois. He later explained, "I wore black to tell the guys that it's over. It's a funeral of Bill Self in that he's no longer with the program. So we've got to move forward and go on." I bring that up because I sense that's what the author of Hebrews is saying in this 12th chapter, the last half of the chapter. Throughout the letter, the author has been encouraging his fellow Jews to move beyond the shadows of Judaism into the light of Christianity. And as he gets close to the end of this letter, he reiterates this theme. I'd like to begin by reading verses 18 to 24. Now, we're going to go back and see a few verses earlier, but this is kind of the central core of his message. "You have not come to a mountain," and by this he means Mount Sinai, "that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, 'I am trembling with fear.' But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel." Mount Sinai, we know, symbolizes the Mosaic Law, the sacrificial system, the Aaronic priesthood, everything associated with Judaism. But by contrast, Christians have come to Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. And I think the author of Hebrews is telling those first century Jewish Christians, get with the program. Move on from the outwardly oriented Judaism to the inwardly oriented Christianity. Now, in saying this, I'm not trying to pit the Old Testament against the New Testament. Although Mount Sinai and Mount Zion can be contrasted, they both speak of the same God whose character never changes. The comparison here between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion is not between bad and good, but between good and better. The argument here, and you find this a lot in Jewish thought, you find it a lot in Paul's epistles, is from lesser to greater. It's often accompanied with the phrase, "How much more? If this is true, how much more is this true? If the law was good, and it was, how much more should we be following Christ, which is the final fulfillment of that law?" And so we see here a transition a transition between one relationship moving into a new phase. The old covenant was not bad, but it was designed to be temporary. I think it's best illustrated in our day and age, the time of engagement before marriage. See, there's a period of time after the couple decides they're going to get married, but before the marriage takes place, where certain rules are in place, at least they should be, maybe not so much today as they used to be, but there are certain expectations of what's done and what's not done. But once the wedding takes place, that all changes, right? Now, it's still the same couple, and it's still the same love. There's still the same commitment, but the relationship has changed. And I believe that's the case, that Jesus made that difference between God and his people. The way of salvation is the same. It's still you're saved by grace through faith. The relationship is the same. God has not changed, but aspects of that relationship have changed. Now, instead of bringing animal sacrifices to the temple, Jesus is our perfect sacrifice. Now, instead of having the priest go into the Holy of Holies once a year on our behalf, we have access to God directly because of Jesus. Things have changed, and the author of Hebrews is saying, get with the program. Quit hanging on to the old that has passed away, and let's get focused on what things are like now. Now, in this message, in this section of Hebrews chapter 12, he explains how to do that. He provides some errors to be evaded. He speaks of the energy to be employed and then the eternity to be embraced. The first error to be evaded is what I'm calling irritability. Verse 14 begins, "Make every effort to live in peace with all men." You know, I think peace is an underappreciated virtue in Christianity. Jesus said in Matthew 5:9, "Blessed are the peacemakers." And notice, "for they shall be called the sons of God." Peace is a very important thing to Jesus. And we are called to live in peace. Paul wrote in Romans 12:18, "If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men." Because quite honestly, people tend to be selfish and abrasive. That's our own sin nature. We want our own way. And we don't like it when other people seem to have it better than us. But that's not the way Christians should be. And notice, peace here is a command. We're going to get into this more in a moment, but it says they must make every effort to attain it. And we're to do so not just so that we can enjoy peace ourselves, but so that the blessing of God's peace can flow through us into the lives of others. Now, don't misunderstand. To be peaceable does not mean that we surrender our convictions, but it does mean that on the whole, we are going to be courteous, considerate, we'll be willing to comply with legitimate social customs, and we're going to refuse to quarrel. Now I ask you, how many Christians do you know that fits that category? Even as believers, we find a hard time to live like that. It seems that many believers think that being a Christian absolves them from all the ordinary obligations of common courtesy and allows them to be rude, not just to non-believers, but to brothers and sisters in Christ as well. But do you realize that every time we encounter an unbeliever, whether it's at work or maybe at a place of business where we're a customer, or maybe it's our business and we're dealing with customers, whenever we deal with people, they are looking at us as Christians in evaluating whether Christianity is worthwhile. And if we're abrasive, and if we're selfish, and if we're quarrelsome, if we can't get along with each other, why in the world would somebody in the outside want to come in? Peace is something that's very, very important. And it's easy to become irritable with each other and to be abrasive with one another. That's our self-sinful nature. But we are to work against that. And we are to, whenever possible, as far as it depends on us, live at peace. You know, when Jesus was here on earth, he was a perfect gentleman. You ever think about that? There's not one place in the Gospels where he was rude, not one place where he was self-centered. And that's the kind of people we ought to be as well. The second error to be evaded is immorality. We continue in verse 14, make every effort to live in peace with all men and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. So peace and holiness are coupled together. The right relationship with fellow believers should accompany a right relationship with God. Now I want you to notice that holiness is both a condition, but it's also a conduct. The author of Hebrews has already described the believers in Hebrews 3:1 as holy brothers. That we are holy by means of our position in Christ. It's called positional sanctification. But our daily conduct isn't always in keeping with our divine calling. So we're to actively pursue holiness. How? By deliberately choosing those things that God would like. We're faced with choices every day. And oftentimes those choices are between what God would have us to do and what the devil would have us do, or what we would have us do, or what our friends would have us do. What are the decisions we make? This is practical sanctification or practical holiness. Making those day-to-day choices that we know are going to please God rather than ourselves or everybody else. Verse 15 continues, see to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root comes up to cause trouble and defile many. Now, I don't think the bitter root here is talking about the attitude of bitterness per se, but it's rather a root that bears bitter fruit or bad fruit. We need to realize that bad fruit doesn't just suddenly appear. It comes from a bad root. Jesus talked about being able to know whether someone's for real by look at the fruit of their lives, because a good tree doesn't bear bad fruit and a bad tree doesn't bear good fruit. Now, I'm not saying that every time you stumble in sin, you're not a good tree, you must be lost. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the overall conduct of our lives. It's going to come out. And it's going to come out of our mouths, it's going to come out of our actions, our reactions. My dad used to always say, you can tell what somebody is filled with by what spills out when they're bumped. Think about that. You can tell what somebody is filled with by what spills out when they're bummed. It's when our lives get shaken up a little bit that people find out what's really on the inside. And here he speaks of a root of immorality. It could be a thought, it could be a fantasy, it could be an inclination. But if we allow that to go unchecked, it will bear fruit. And that will be a word or an action or maybe a habit. And immorality tends to be contagious towards others. It brings the whole community down. Notice verse 16. See that no one is sexually immoral. That Greek term there rendered immoral is pornos in the Greek. It's where we get pornography from. He's definitely talking about this area of life. Now, the Old Testament has passages that uses immorality, like adultery, as a metaphor for idolatry, for worshiping other gods. And some have felt that's the way this should be taken here, or this could mean quite literally. Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 3 through 8, it is God's will that you should be sanctified. That word means holy, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the heathen who don't know God, and that in this matter no one should wrong his brother or take advantage of him. God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. And getting back to this passage in Hebrews, what does he say about holiness? Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. So this is a very important error that must be evaded. And in a society that teaches that anything goes, we need to hear this today. Now, the first two virtues, peace and holiness, appear elsewhere together in Hebrews. A few verses earlier, the author speaks of a harvest of righteousness and peace. I think it's in verse 12 or verse 11. In Hebrews 7:2, he refers to Melchizedek. Remember Melchizedek, the king of Salem? His name meant king of righteousness or holiness, and his title was the king of peace. Peace and holiness coming together. So these two form a goal that we should pursue as we run the race of the Christian life. A third error, and I think this is the most insidious of all, is what I'm calling indifference. Verses 16 and 17 say, "See to it that no one is immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold the inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. He could bring about no change of mind, though he sought the blessing with tears." Most of us are probably familiar with that story of Jacob and Esau, twin boys. Esau was born first, so he was technically the firstborn. But we know that he sold his birthright for a bowl of stew. And then later, his brother Jacob tricked their father into giving him the blessing that should have gone to the firstborn. Now, Esau here is described as a godless person. And I know sometimes we think about a godless person as being blasphemous, as being filthy, being just a scoundrel, a terrible kind of a person. I don't think that's really the kind of picture you see in the Bible. Esau was a good guy. He's the kind of guy you'd like to have as a neighbor. He was a good hunter. He was a man that loved his father. He seemed to be an all right person. The only problem was he wasn't interested in the things of God. That's what it means that he was godless. I don't know that he was an atheist. He may have believed there was a God. He was a practical atheist. He just lived like there wasn't one. He didn't have time for the things of God. He couldn't be bothered with spiritual things. And I think Esau here is a warning for us not to live our lives for lesser things. Not to fill up our calendars and our schedules with so many things that take us away from God and away from God's people that we just don't have the time or energy to serve Him. That's the kind of person Esau was, and the author of Hebrews says, don't be like that. In order to get with the program, we need to evade these errors of irritability with each other, with immorality toward God, and with indifference toward spiritual things. Now the author moves on and further points out the effort to be employed. I want to go back to verse 14. Those first three words, make every effort. And this is a strong term. It expresses something of the eagerness of pursuit. This isn't something lackadaisical. We really want this. We're committed to this. Literally, it means to run swiftly in order to catch some person or thing. To press on, to run after. And we're back into that athletic mindset here. It's someone who runs a race swiftly to reach a goal. There's a sense of urgency about it. There's an intensity of purpose here. Kenneth Wiest, in his translation of the New Testament, renders this as constantly be eagerly seeking after. Once again, this isn't ho-hum, oh well, I guess if there's nothing better to do, I'll go to church. This is an attitude that I'm excited about this. I'm passionate about this. Now, I ask you, what are you passionate about? What fires you up? You know, for some of us, it is sports. For some of us, it's hunting or fishing or being outside or gardening or whatever it might be. And I'm not saying these are bad things. I think it's good to be passionate about something, otherwise your life is pretty boring. But shouldn't we be passionate about the things of God? Shouldn't we be passionate about learning from His Word? Could you imagine if people came to church with the same passion they brought to a ball game? You know, the only place in our society, really, where you have public group singing, other than church, is the seventh inning stretch at a baseball game, right? Now, I always think of Wrigley Field back in the days of Harry Carey, and boy, he'd get the whole crowd riled up. You know, they'd sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" in, you know, 27,000 different keys. Nobody cares how good they sound, but boy, they belt it out. They're passionate. And that's what we ought to be, but we ought to be passionate about the right things. Be passionate about the things of God. And I wonder sometimes if the reason why our testimony seems to fall flat is because we come across like the door-to-door salesman that when the person opens the door says, "You don't want to buy this, do you?" You know, there's no passion there.
"Oh yeah, I'm a Christian. I just couldn't be happier."
No one's going to be convinced by that. Be passionate, but be passionate about the right things. There's another verb translated in verse 15 as "see to it." It's a compound word, and it's an unusual one. It conveys the idea of an oversight. In fact, we get the word episcopal from this, like a bishop, somebody overseeing others. And I'll be honest with you, when I first read this in the English, I thought he was being very personal. You, individually, see to it that this takes place. But when you understand the original word, he's speaking here of the group, the body, the church. See to it that everybody in your group is functioning in a certain way. We need to care for each other. We need to be concerned for one another. We need to be mindful that when somebody else is down, that we can be there to help them up. It's not enough that we finish the race ourselves. This is a team effort. And there's the old slogan the military has, you know, "No soldier left behind." That's the idea we need to have in the church. No believer left behind. Yes, it's wonderful that we're running our race and that we're making strides in our Christian life, but what about the other people around you? Are they? Do you care? So not only do we need to see to it ourselves, we need to see to it that all of us are progressing in the Christian life. We need to look out for each other. And in both cases, the effort to be employed is no half-hearted attempt. It's going to take commitment. It's going to take hard work. It's going to take teamwork. Now, it's true, our strength comes from the Lord, but we must put that strength to work in our lives. And then finally, there's an eternity to be embraced. Unlike Esau, who could only live for the here and now, we must look beyond our physical, temporary world that we live in. And when we stop and compare what we have now to what we're going to have then, there really is no comparison, is there? Paul said that our sufferings aren't even worth being compared to the glory that's going to be revealed in us. Now, embracing eternity means, first, we need to be receptive. God is speaking to us today through His Word. He speaks through His workings in the world. We'd better listen. After comparing and contrasting Mount Sinai and Mount Zion, the author presses home this need to listen in verse 25. "See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven?" See, the kingdom of heaven is something we must receive. It's not earned. It's not created by us. It is God's gift. But there isn't anything automatic about it. We must receive it. We must embrace it. We must allow it to revolutionize our lives. Second, we are to be ready. Verses 26 and 27. At that time, speaking of Mount Sinai when the law was given to Moses, his voice shook the earth. But now he has promised once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. When God gave the law on Mount Sinai to Moses, we're told that the whole earth shook. It was like an earthquake. Scared people to death. God's presence was so powerful. His majesty was so in evidence that the earth just shook. But centuries later, the prophet Haggai, he's one of my favorites. I love Haggai. I think this is the only place Haggai is quoted in the New Testament. Haggai comes along and says, there's going to come a day when God's going to shake the earth and the heavens. Everything is going to be shaken. Why? Because the temporary is going to fall away, and we're going to be left with what's permanent, what's eternal. And that's the whole point. It's to separate out the temporary from the permanent, just like the chaff and the grain are separated by the wind. We know that from God's word, everything on this earth will eventually come to an end, making a way for the eternal reality that will never end. Yet, so many Christians involve their whole lives about what's here and now. They're more committed to the stuff of earth than they are the kingdom of heaven. And when they get to the end, they're going to have nothing to show for their lives. So the way to be ready for eternity is to invest our time, our treasures, and our talents into those things that are going to last, as opposed to those things that aren't. And you say, what's going to last into eternity? Two things. God and human souls, including our own. And we need to be all about knowing God and making Him known, bringing as many souls as possible with us into heaven, because that's really all that's going to last from this earth. So I ask you, what are we investing our lives in tonight? Are we ready right now to stand before God? And then thirdly, to embrace eternity means to be reverent. Verses 28 and 29 conclude, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful. And so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Now, I'm not saying that our reaction needs to be one of fear or dread like the Israelites. That's not the point. But there needs to be gratitude in our hearts toward God and a humble reverence that takes God seriously. I think that's what our worship should be about. Instead of complaining or worrying as we see our world shaking, give God praise and thanks. Take a look around. Does it really seem that the world's getting any better? Do the prospects of Christians look brighter or bleaker in the days to come? The answers, these seem obvious. So what do we do in response? We can stick our heads in the sand and pretend it isn't happening. We can moan and groan our way through life, ruining our testimony along the way. We can abandon ship and just live like the world. Or we can get with the program and live for the Lord. And that's what the author of Hebrews is telling not only his first century audience, but his 21st century audience as well. I'd like to end tonight with a closing hymn. I know we don't always do this on Sunday evening, but I think it would be appropriate. Turn to hymn number 250. Hymn number 250. And let's stand as we sing and as we close. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. The good news is we know who holds tomorrow, and we know He holds our hand. We're just going to sing the first verse as we close.